You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
For our session this afternoon, I'm really delighted to welcome Ian Christie, who's with us. He's talking on Enough is Enough. One of the questions that always confronts us here in Hot House is, what can I actually do about it? What difference can I make? And I think Ian's going to have something to say to us about how we get into all of that. And I very much look to what he has to share with us this afternoon. So without any more from me, Ian, welcome. We look forward to hearing you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you very much, and hello, Hot House. I've never been to Greenbelt before. That's what one of my ambitions has been fulfilled. But I've lost a bet about Greenbelt. It's my wife bet me that I'd be the I wouldn't be the only person wearing a tie. And I have to say, I do feel overdressed. But to me, this is beach-ready casual. So you're. You'll have to allow me that. So thank you very much for coming along. This is the best turnout I've seen since before I became an academic. And I'm about to retire as an associate professor at the University of Surrey. And I'm using the nearness of retirement to let loose a bit about climate policy and what we might do politically to get out of the stuckness that we have in so many respects in relation to climate action and the planetary crisis overall. And the message I've got is that I've had enough. And many of you might well have had enough as well. I mean that in two senses. First of all, I've had enough of the can being kicked down the road, especially by my generation. I'm 68. We've been kicking the can down the road on climate action. We've done quite a bit, but we haven't done enough. And especially not in relation to all the other crises which are linked to climate, such as the crisis of biodiversity. So I've had enough of seeing the can kicked down the road. But I've also had enough in another sense. I have had enough good fortune, enough wealth, and enough income. I don't need anymore. In fact, I probably need less. And people like me, and there are hundreds of millions like me, have had utopian lives. We've got better lives than anyone could have dreamed of hundreds of years ago. The life we've got here today, this is utopia for most of the people who've ever lived and for most people on Earth. And we ought to let that sink in. Those of us who are lucky enough to have had the kind of lives that I've had, which is not an exceptional one in the West in the post-war years, have got enough. We've arrived at a quasi-utopian standard of living. We don't need any more. And that's got implications for how we deal with the climate crisis. So I'm going to treat you as a focus group for a campaign which I would like to see emerge. We don't need to call it Enough is Enough. I'm just using the phrase Enough is Enough. Others have taken over that term. Lots of groups have been using the idea of enoughness. But I want to put to you that we need a rolling campaign over the next decade or so to enlist the affluent of the world, which includes me, maybe includes many of you, in arguing that we should be paying more taxes and that we should be making common cause with the poor of the earth and with our children and grandchildren. And we should be saying enough is enough. We've had enough. We've had enough. We want to live more lightly so that others can have enough. Now, I'm going to argue that we've got enough of lots of things to make progress with our climate crisis, our nature crisis, all the interweaving crises that we call the poly crisis. We've got enough evidence that we need to act. We should have enough motivation that we need to act. We've got enough technology pretty well to help us act. And we've certainly got enough money. And if you don't believe me, I'll give some figures about that. What we don't have enough of is political will. So often, no doubt this will come up when Carla Denyer speaks, the thing that we lack, in the West especially, is political willpower to act on the evidence that we've got about accumulating climate crises and nature crises. So why don't we have enough political willpower? Well, there are many answers to that question, but one of the answers is this, that our politicians are by and large afraid of affluent people like me, because they don't think we will tolerate being asked to pay more taxes. They don't think we have got common cause. They're worried that we won't vote for them if they say, vote for us and we will increase your taxes. We are going to demand more of you. And one of my appeals is that if you agree with me, we need to put a lot of pressure on policymakers to put more demands on the likes of us. Okay, so that's part of this campaign, this idea, which I'm hoping to enlist you in. So I'm going to treat you as a big focus group. And I've tried this idea out already on a church congregation, two community groups, a bunch of NGO leaders, a few academics, and one bishop, okay? And no one has told me this is nonsense. So I'm hoping you won't either. So let's see how we go. And I want to also put into your mind a comment by Danny Dorling, the geographer from Oxford University. He's published a very good book called The Next Crisis, just come out. And in that, he says, it's amazing that we don't talk more about the impact of the affluent on the climate crisis in particular, but on our other ecological crises as well. And we should talk about it much more because, and he counts himself in the ranks of the global top 1%, the global top 1% are responsible for the bulk of the emissions, over half of the emissions that we need to deal with. We need to talk about this much more, something that is an inconvenient truth. Politicians don't like to mention it, but it is a fact. And Dorling says in his book, and I want this to stick with you, he says climate crisis is to a large extent, a crisis of overconsumption by the undertaxed rich. Crisis of overconsumption by the undertaxed rich. And I mean me in that group as well. Okay. So let me say a bit more about why what we've got enough of and then what we need more of. So first of all, evidence. We have got more than enough evidence that we need. I shouldn't think there's a single climate denier or delayer in the room, but you do meet them quite often and you need to be able to reassure them that we've got more than enough evidence. An NHS doctor said to me the other day, if he meets a climate denier, he'll say to them, what do you think about the evidence that the doctors have got when they give you a surgery? Is that good enough for you? And the climate denier will say, yes, that evidence is good enough for me. And he then says, well, actually, the climate science is stronger than that. Is that good enough for you? It's true. We don't need any more evidence of what we've got. We need detailed evidence about particular trends, but the overall picture is completely unshakable that we're heading for an overheating world. The way we're going at the moment, we're going to reach maybe 2.5 degrees C rise by the end of the century. It could be worse and it could be better. We could get it down to maybe just under 2 degrees C if everybody does what they say they're going to do. That's still risky. That's still risky, and we need to avoid it. So we've got plenty of evidence, and that evidence has been piling up not since the 1990s, not since the 1980s, not since the 1970s, but since the late 19th century, maybe even earlier. Now, there's also enough evidence about something else, which is the whole range of ecological life support systems that we need, which scientists now call the planetary boundaries. So a sustainable life, a healthy life for humans and other creatures is lived within these planetary boundaries. There are 9 of them. If you picture these as a dashboard, I can show you that on slides about this. By the way, you're getting off very lightly. There's a 71-slide presentation, which I'll make available to anybody who wants it. I'll give my email at the end. And you can see the planetary boundaries in those slides. So there are 9 of them, and we've breached about 6 of them. Okay, so we've destabilized 6 of the life support systems that we all depend on. Some arguments say that we've got to 7 that have been destabilized. So there's very good evidence of that. So that taken together the evidence of climate crisis, the evidence of broader ecological crisis, that gives us enough motivation, or ought to, and it should give us enough moral motivation as well. So there are two kinds of motivation which ought to be enough. First of all, self-preservation and self-interest. Second, the moral case. You don't need to look long, and I'm sure all of you here understand this, you don't need to look very long at all of the statistics about climate change to realise it's immediately a moral question. The people who are going to be hit first and worst, who have been hit first and worst, are the ones who are poorest, most vulnerable, least equipped to deal with the problems and to adapt, and who've done little or nothing to generate the problem. So when you realise that, there's an immediate moral challenge to those of us who are in the countries and in the classes who've been emitting greenhouse gas emissions most. And that means me. So there's a sense of responsibility. I have had a fantastic carbon inheritance, which I have helped burn up in the course of my lifetime. And I've known about it. Let's be generous. I've known about it since the late 1980s because I'm an academic. Many of you might not have known about it until 10 years ago, 15 years ago. But once you know about something like that, there is a responsibility. If you know that harm is being caused, then there's a responsibility to do something about it. If we know that we're causing harm and we don't act, then we're being irresponsible. So that's one issue. Then there's another issue. If we care about justice, we should care about the impacts on the poor and vulnerable of the world. And we should also care about the future, because the emissions that I've been sending up into the atmosphere through my consumption during my lifetime do not simply affect us here and now. They will have a long lifetime in the atmosphere. They'll contribute to a long-lasting problem which will affect my daughter, her children, and their children. So if we care about our kids and our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, which I'm sure we all do, we ought to care about reducing our impact on the climate. So we've got very, very good motivation. We've got enough motivation as well as enough evidence. We've also got nearly enough of all of the technologies that we're going to need to deal with our emissions. We can decarbonize an awful lot. We don't need new magic technologies. We just need to deploy at very large scale and speedily the ones we already know about, especially renewable energy and energy conservation techniques. We probably don't need new nuclear. We probably don't need very much carbon capture and storage if we really take renewables seriously and energy conservation. So we've got enough technology, although technology is not all that's going to be needed. We've also got, and this is a crucial point to make, we've got enough money. So let's see if you can do better than my students. Can we have some estimates in the room for the size of the world economy? So if the world were a country, what would its GDP be? Any bids? $3 trillion. $3 trillion. Any advances on $3 trillion? $700 trillion. Any decrease on $700 trillion? $55 trillion. You're about 50% below what it is. It's around $105 trillion, give or take a trillion. And when you're up to that level, $1 trillion hardly makes a difference. Now, Jeffrey Sachs, the American sustainable development economist, always says that when people say to him, "That's a very large sum, I'm not sure the world can afford it," he says, "You divide it by $105 trillion and see how expensive it then looks." So the world economy is about $105 trillion, roughly. What about the size of the UK economy? 40 quid. It feels like 40 quid to Rachel Reeves, but are there any advances on 40 quid? 2.5 trillion. You need to go up a bit. It's around 3 trillion. Okay. Now, you might have heard some politicians say we can't afford net zero because that's going to bankrupt the country. I won't name her, but she's leader of the Conservative Party. It's going to bankrupt the country, okay? So how much is it going to cost? Net zero. It's round about 2% of that GDP. Okay. So we divide by our 3 trillion, and it turns out that going for net zero is not going to bankrupt the country at all. In fact, it's not going to come close to doing that. What else do we spend about 2% of GDP on? Well, all sorts of things. You might remember, looking around, I can see that you're all roughly the same age as me, I think. You'll remember the 1980s, the fact that we went for mass adoption of computers, didn't we? I did a very rough fag packet calculation of the proportion of GDP that we'd spent globally on doing that. It was around 6%. Okay. And when we fight world wars, we spend an awful lot more as a proportion of our GDP. So when it comes to decarbonizing and securing climate security, 2% of GDP seems pretty cheap price to pay. Now, I've got a badge on here, which has got the 17 global goals for sustainable development of the United Nations on them. Okay, so this includes climate action, biodiversity action, eliminating absolute poverty, eliminating starvation, fostering global security, gender equality, all sorts of good things. And the estimate for achieving the UN goals for sustainable development, which are meant to be achieved by 2030, is around 6 to 7% of global GDP. That's a lot of money. But again, we divide by 105 trillion, and it looks pretty affordable. If I mention to you that we spend, this is a necessarily inexact estimate, roughly $1 trillion a year on bribes, you can see that achieving the sustainable development goals looks pretty affordable by comparison. We've got plenty of money. The proportion of GDP that we need to spend is nothing like as much as many people would have you believe. And yet we feel as though the economy is worth 40 quid, as somebody said in the audience just now. And lots of people think we are incredibly hard-pressed when it comes to affording the transition to more sustainable development and to doing decarbonisation and achieving the SDGs. Now, we've had an extraordinary amount of economic growth in the world to get to that 105 trillion over the past 40 years. So you might well be justified in asking, well, where's all the money gone? And there are many answers to that, but one of the most important is that an awfully large proportion of the gains from GDP growth since 1980 have been captured by the top 1%. 27% is the estimate of global GDP growth that's been captured by the top 1% of earners. That's why we feel, that's one of the reasons why we feel the economy is worth 40 quid, when in fact it's worth 3 trillion. The money has gone into personal consumption and into personal assets. It's not gone into the long-range infrastructure investment that we need to secure our futures and secure our children's futures and to get climate security and ecological security. So the money is there, it's just often in the wrong places. So we in the affluent world have got more than enough. And it's a shock to realise just how affluent we are. Now, full disclosure, I earn, at least I do until next week when I retire, I earn in the high five figures. Okay? So that puts me easily into the global top 10%. Easily. Puts me into the UK top 10%. That may be true of many of you in the room. Often when you say to people who might be on a £90,000 a year, you're in the top 10% in the UK, they don't believe it. Because they think the economy is worth 40 quid. They don't necessarily understand where they sit in the hierarchy of wealth and income. Globally speaking, we are amazingly rich. Historically speaking, we are utopianly rich if we're in those upper five figures. In fact, worldwide, if we're earning more than about £35,000, we're well into the top 10%. most people are much, much poorer than us. So we in the affluent world have got more than enough. If we look at our wealth as well as our income, now I live in a small terraced house in southwest London. If I add that into my income, that puts me in the global top 4%. And if I sell that house, I'm going to have an enormous uplift. It's going to be worth three times what I paid for it 23 years ago. I've done nothing to make that happen. I've won the historical lottery, and so have many, many, many millions of people won a lottery, but they've done nothing to earn that uplift. That doesn't make us bad people. It makes us incredibly lucky people who need to do something to recognize, to show gratitude for that sheer luck, the sheer exceptionalism of our position historically and in the world. So I've done nothing to increase the value of the house. I've done a bit of DIY here and there, of course, but that's probably decreased the value of the house. Even when I retire in 2 weeks' time and my income is halved, I'll still be comfortably within the global top 5%. So we've got to keep that in mind. We've got, if we're in the top 10% in the UK, we have won the historical lottery of life. We are incredibly well off, historically and globally. And the top 1% and the top 0.1% in particular are massively wealthier even than us, extraordinarily so. And even though they like to think that they've made all that money for themselves, and I'm not denying their fantastic skill in all sorts of things and their drive, but an awful lot of the gains that they've got are, again, simply due to compound interest, to the uplift in property values, all kinds of asset values, which they have done nothing to cause. So they, too, have won the lottery of life. The Christian economist Jeremy Williams and his co-author Catherine Trebeck wrote a wonderful book in 2019 called The Economics of Arrival, and they argued that those of us in the top 10% have arrived. We don't need to go any further in personal consumption. As I said before, we're already at a utopian level of affluence. So we've got enough. We've got enough evidence. We've got enough motivation. We've got enough technology. And we've got enough money. But what we don't have is, so far, the political willpower to act. We ought to think as well about the impact that we're having as part of the global 10%. So if you're in the top 10% globally, you are part of 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions. Your consumption generates over 50%. The poorest of the world generate very, very little of those greenhouse gas emissions. And if you're in the top 1% or top 0.1% of earners worldwide, your contribution to the emissions is around 15%. You're part of what the academic Dario Kenner calls, this is a phrase we might want to think about throwing around a lot more, the polluter elite. And nobody wants to be in the polluter elite, do they? They shouldn't want to. Two-thirds of the heating that we've got going on, the global heating that we've got going on, is attributable to the global top 10%. That means me, okay? Now, I'm trying to do my best, and I'm probably driving down my carbon footprint more than most, but I'm still part of that group, and I've not influenced my group, that global 10%, nearly enough. And I want to come on to how we might do that a bit later on. But just to underline the point, this is not just about climate change. This is also about the wider planetary crisis that we've got, the overloading of our life support systems. There is also a link between affluence and those life support systems being destabilized. And recent research suggests that the consumption of my group, the top 10%, has contributed one-third to a half of all the impacts, the negative impacts on our life support systems. And the top 20% of consumers worldwide contribute most of the rest of the impacts. So that's pretty sobering. The good news is, if that top 20% of consumers changed their behaviour so that we lived more lightly on the Earth, as we know we can, and as we know will make almost no difference to our living standards and actually improve our quality of life, I can testify to that, we might come onto that in questions, then we could see pretty rapid reductions in the environmental stresses we're putting on our life support systems, 25% up to maybe even over 50%. The estimates are necessarily uncertain. There are big uncertainties here, but you can see the direction of the evidence. So to sum up so far, we know enough about what we need to do. We should have enough motivation. We've got enough technology. We've got enough money. We need to build up the political willpower, and we're not making anything like enough progress so far. If we look at what we need to do by the end of the century, ideally well before then, we've got to get to a position where most of the world has got very, very minimal carbon emissions, if not zero, and is having net positive impacts on all of our ecological life support systems at the same time as giving everyone a good standard of living. Only one country, Costa Rica, is showing any signs of going in the right direction, and even they are a long way off where we need to be. So we're not in sight of where we've got to get to. We can't hope either that technology is going to do all the work, because even if magic technologies are on the horizon, that horizon is still many decades away. We're going to have to act in advance of rescue technologies coming to save us from making inconvenient changes to our lifestyles, what might be experienced as inconvenient changes. Who has got to lead on making changes to their lifestyles? Well, it needs to be the most affluent, the people who've enjoyed the carbon budget so far to the full, people like me. We're the ones who've got to lead on making the changes. Now, that might seem like mission impossible. How on earth are we going to persuade the affluent of the world to demand that they pay more taxes and contribute more and have common cause with the world's poor, because the direction of travel has been completely away from that for the past 40 to 50 years, all of my working lifetime? Mission impossible. It sounds like it's beyond even Tom Cruise plus a cast of superheroes. And it comes with a big political dilemma. There's a political economist, Danny Roderick, who's written a very interesting piece recently about what he calls the 21st century trilemma. What does he mean by that? Well, he says we need to combat climate change, reduce global poverty, and we've also got to bolster the middle classes in the West, who are feeling very precarious. Even though we're very rich, we're feeling like we're in a 40 quid economy. And he says you can only do two out of three of those things at any one point, given the policy framework that we've currently got. So we can't simultaneously deal with poverty, climate change, and improve the situation of the middle classes. Well, if he's right, then we really are stuck. But I don't think he is right, because we can change the framework in which we've been operating. The top 10% of us in the West have got the capacity to act, and I think there is potentially the political constituency that we can build up to make a reality of the potential to act for a more sustainable world, to get the affluent to lead and get the affluent to demand that they pay more taxes, that politicians ask more of them. You might be surprised to know that the survey evidence that we've got says that the Western top 10% want to see more equality. They want to reduce poverty. They think that inequalities have got too deep, too alarming in the West. They would like to see better public services. They would be willing to pay more taxes. We get this message consistently. We get it as well from the top 1%, even from part of the top 0.1%, you might have heard of a new group called the Patriotic Millionaires. It's a network of millionaires and billionaires in the UK, in USA and elsewhere, who are demanding to pay more taxes. So far, they've not been listened to, and I think they need to have their voice amplified by the rest of us in the top 10%. And that's what I'll come on to. To really get us to the point where many people in my group, the top 10%, will take action, we need to work on lots of things. We need more trust in government to spend tax revenues wisely. So that trust has got to be built up. We've got to have better performance in the public sector so that the top 10% are willing not to go private and willing to take part in services which the poorer people depend on. They need more sense of security for themselves, because many people in the top 10% are feeling quite precarious, especially in the face of AI. And above all, they need to have confidence that the top 1% and the top 0.1% are going to pay their share. And that's what they don't have confidence in at the moment. They also need to know that they're going to be recognised for leading by example. And there's really interesting research on this, which I just want to mention. It's all in the slides if you want them at the end. But Steve Westlake, colleague of mine, social scientist, has done some great recent research which shows that there's a big demand from the public to see celebrities, political leaders, business leaders, the affluent, lead by example in reducing carbon footprints. And if they did that, if they saw that happen, that would make them much more willing to support net zero policies, all sorts of other shifts that we need to have a more sustainable economy. That's also the message that comes through with patriotic millionaires. They want to be seen to be leading by example. The evidence suggests that if people in the top 10% and especially the top 1% did lead by example and publicly acted and spoke about changing their lifestyles in order to give us a more sustainable future, they would be rewarded with more solidarity and support politically. Now, the same researcher, Steve Westlake, also found, when he put this to politicians, that the politicians didn't really believe it. And they also felt that if they acted by example, they would be regarded as hypocrites. They would be seen as being holier than thou. But the evidence says, no, that wouldn't be true. They should take a risk on it. People like me should take the risk of wanting to lead by example and wanting to speak about it and wanting to join forces, make common cause about leading by example. And the other useful bit of social science research that's going on at the moment says that if we get to a point where there's a critical mass of people within a group like the top 10% who are willing to take concerted action, it can lead to what we call in the jargon a positive social tipping point, where you start getting momentum which becomes politically unstoppable, as we've seen, for example, with big movements like the abolition of slavery and the civil rights movement. Can we do the same thing for the mobilisation of the affluent to demand that they pay more taxes, to demand that they are supported in moving rapidly to low and zero carbon lifestyles? Well, I'm encouraged by patriotic millionaires, and I think we need to expand their movement. So my Enough is Enough is a rough shorthand for a new coalition which would incorporate patriotic millionaires and many other groups, including those who are already using phrases like Enough is Enough. And I would hope that everybody in this tent would join us so that Hothouse Earth can become much cooler. And there's a big menu of things that we can demand. We should be demanding higher income taxes, because believe me, we can afford it. We should be demanding taxes on our pensions, because we can afford that too. We've done really well over the past 40 years. We should be demanding more taxes on our property and our land and our capital gains, because believe me, we can afford it. And we've had so many unearned gains over the last 40 years. As I said before, I have done nothing to get a threefold increase in my house value. Some of that should be taken away from me. And if nobody will take it away, I'm going to give part of it away. But I also want to contribute beyond myself. I want to be part of a bigger movement. So we should put that on the table. We should also put on the table a carbon tax and a carbon dividend, where some of the proceeds from that tax is paid to the poorer in society so that they can also afford a just transition to sustainable living. We should put on the table the Tobin tax, a tax on financial transactions worldwide. We should put on the table luxury taxes. I think it should be more expensive for Jeff Bezos to have a wedding where he hires Venice. And as somebody said at the time, if you can afford to hire Venice, Jeff, you can afford to pay your taxes. We should campaign hard against tax evasion and tax avoidance. We should tighten up loopholes. We should be campaigning very hard against corruption. We should be looking at windfall taxes. We should be looking at taxes on the profits of fossil fuel companies. We should be looking at getting rid of subsidies for fossil fuels and deforestation. We should be looking at a tax on the social media companies, which I would call an information pollution tax. Our information ecosystems are being polluted. We should tax the pollution. Another fag packet calculation tells me that Rachel Reeves' black hole would easily be filled if we did that. So there's a lot we can put on the table. I haven't exhausted all the different taxes we could go for. But we need to say very loudly and clearly in the top 10%, we want to be taxed more. Your job as politician should not be to drive down our taxes. It should be to enlist us in common cause, because taxes are the entry price for a civilized society, for the services that we all need. And we need to say that very loudly, because the politicians are not listening hard enough to that. They're not even listening to the patriotic millionaires who are demanding that they pay more taxes. So we need a campaign which enlists them all and says enough is enough. That campaign, I think, needs to include the churches, patriotic millionaires, NGOs, and crucially, it's got to include business leaders, and it's got to include people on the centre-right as well. I'm sure most of us here on the liberal left, the green left, we need to reach out way beyond our ranks to the centre-right and make sure they're enlisted as well. In a rolling campaign, a slow-burn campaign, which will go on well into the 2030s, where we talk endlessly about how we've got enough and how we should be making common cause and investing through our taxes in the infrastructures that will protect our children, their grandchildren, and the poor of the earth. So just to sum up, we've got enough. And we've had enough. We've had enough of kicking the can down the road. We've got enough evidence that we need to stop doing that. We've got the technology. We've got the motivation, or should have. We've got the money. It's in the wrong places a lot of the time, but we've got the money. And there are enough of us to start making a difference. So I hope you'll agree with me that we need something to start millions of people saying to policymakers all over the world, but especially starting here in the UK, enough is enough. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ian, for such a challenging and thought-provoking presentation and summarising so eloquently the problems that present us, but what we have enough of that enables us to address them should we have the will. I'm very pleased to say, got time for questions. We will endeavour to get a range of questions from around the room. And I'm grateful to Michael, who will bring the microphone as near as possible to you. He will hold it for you. Please, can I ask you keep your question short and to the point so that we get questions rather than long comments or stories or anecdotes that mean that other people don't get the chance to ask their question. So, okay, we will start at the front.
I'll hold the mic. Hello, many thanks. Would you be in favour of using the tax system to drive behaviours? For example, get rid of the CGT, principal private residence exemption, for the sale of all residences unless they meet certain environmental standards?
Yes, absolutely. One thing I would say about taxes is that we should be much more creative. We should be doing things like frequent flyer levies, which would help change behaviour. But before you bring in any tax changes, and the Chancellor is planning some big tax changes, what you need to do is enlist the public in a debate about why we need more taxes, rather than try to smuggle them in. So instead of doing things surreptitiously, we should be absolutely explicit about what we're trying to do. But behaviour change should be part of it. But we need to be upfront about that.
Next. There are two parts to life. There's for many of us, and that is a mortgage and no longer having a mortgage. And you become affluent when you no longer have a mortgage. Otherwise, many of us don't have that much extra left over. And you did mention one of the key things was about offering security to people. And what concerns me is one thing you've missed is the social care guarantee. The only reason why I need assets really now is because I'm uncertain, because the government has never given me the assurance of looking after me in my old age. And if we did that, that security would be one of the key things that would actually tip the balance in terms of what people think they need.
Yep.
I completely agree. One of the reasons we need higher taxes is to make sure that we can get as many people as possible into really good social care public services, because otherwise we're going to end up with an American system where the poorest get the worst services and everyone else has to try to fend for themselves. Funnily enough, in the UK at the moment, we've got a UK health service, but we've got a pretty American social care system. And we need urgently to integrate social care with the NHS. There's a whole other debate to be had on that, but you're absolutely right. That is a source of enormous insecurity, and it means that many of us have ended up treating our houses as our pensions. That's the last thing we should be doing. Now, it's going to take decades to unwind all of that, but we won't start doing it unless we have a really honest debate about tax. But thank you for that comment.
Do you think that in a situation where we might not have confidence in some of the people in government benefiting personally, financially, from being in government, we may not have confidence for where the money's going. Would this go well hand in hand with a future generations bill such as they have in Wales?
It's a great question. I'm completely in favour of a future generations bill as they have in Wales. I really hope to see that. Should we trust politicians? Well, we have to in the end. Hope that if they have the confidence that there is a big movement, kind that I've been sketching out, that there is a solid consensus and they can be brave. Politicians are often not leaders. They exercise followership. They wait to see if we give them permission to lead. And that's what we need to give them. And the other thing to say, and this is a reprimand against myself, is if we want better politicians, we need to start going into politics ourselves. I've only run for office once in my life, and I came a resounding last for the Green Party. But that was a mistake. I should have done it much more. Maybe it's something I can do in the future. But if we want to have more confidence in politicians, then maybe more of us should think about going into politics. But pending that, we definitely need something like a future generations bill, and we need more standards like that to hold politicians to promises about the public good and the future. Great comment.
Yeah, I'm all for taxing the rich, but you mentioned taxing pensions. Would you apply that to a poor pensioner whose only source of income is the state pension? There are a lot of them, believe me.
No, I'm thinking of private pensions. Yeah.
Hello, it's good. It's very refreshing to hear you talk about the reaching out to the centre-right, because too much of this debate is mired in left-right politics, and I think this transcends that. So well done. Brilliant.
Well, just on that point, there is a good tradition on the centre-right of environmental conservation, and it's been drowned out rather. So if any of you want to support the Conservative Environment Network, I'm not a member of the Conservative Party, but we absolutely need the Conservative Party to embrace these issues. And there is a group called the Conservative Environment Network who do good work on this. So yes, absolutely. We've got to reach out and make sure the whole spectrum of people within the top 10% are brought in. Now, I did hear your comment, actually, Adam. Thank you very much. So, yeah.
The question simply is, how do I vote?
Yeah.
Because none of the present ways of voting for rich people being taxed more seem to make any difference to me. They make me worse off as in the middle or very low middle, to 2/9 of what you earn.
Yep. I'm talking about the, as Keir Starmer said before he became Prime Minister, those with the broadest shoulders bearing the greatest burden. So I'm wanting ultra-progressive taxation here. That's what I'm arguing for. So this is not putting the burden up on the poorest at all. This is asking those of us who are lucky and rich, in global terms and in UK terms, to bear much more of the burden, recognising that we have had unbelievably fortunate lives. So it would not put the burden up on poor pensioners at all.
Hi there. You said at the beginning you were speaking out because you were approaching retirement. What prevented you from speaking out before? And for those of us who are fortunate enough to have a little bit more time before we approach retirement, what should we be doing?
Yeah. Well, I've been saying this to anyone who'll listen for a long time, actually. But this is the biggest audience I've had for it, so that's good. What I would ask people to do is talk about this for a start. One of the things that we don't do enough of is talk about climate crisis and nature crisis. So the Christian climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe, when she's asked about what's the most important thing to do, she always says, "Well, we're going to talk about it to friends, colleagues, family." People are often deeply shy about it. And it's very awkward to talk about being in the top 10% and to admit to ourselves, if we're comfortable and in the top 10%, that we are rich. We're rich globally, we're rich historically, and that we should be paying more. So we need to talk about it. And I have been talking about it a lot, I have to say. What we've got to do is make this a normal part of conversation with MPs and policymakers. So if you do nothing else, go home and write about what you've heard. If you agree with it, write about what you've heard to your MP and keep doing it. Keep doing it. It has to become normalised as part of what MPs hear from the public.
You alluded earlier at the beginning of your talk to how simplification had led to an increasing quality of life. I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I have a no-fly policy. It's not absolute. I've flown 3 times in 25 years. And that simplifies my life enormously. And it gives you greater quality of life, not knowing that you don't have to go to Gatwick or Heathrow more than once every 15 years or so. it simplifies your life as well. That I travel by train a lot, which costs me a lot of money, which means I think very hard about whether I'm going to travel somewhere or not. Same with a car. You also realise that the things in life that you value most are to do with the public goods on which we all depend. There's a great joy in going to a public park for free. It's amazing that we can do that. The sign that dystopia will have arrived is when the turnstiles go up in our public parks and they become privatised goods. So holding on to things like that, realising that there's a huge amount of joy to be had from a public space and gathering like this, that's what I regard as adding joy to my life, and it's not about accumulating more new things. Also, as you can tell by what I'm wearing, I don't buy many new clothes, you know. That simplifies your life as well. Yeah.
Hi, do you think our tax returns and our net worth should be published as a matter of
course, so everyone knows how much we pay in tax and how wealthy we are.
Yes, I do. And one thing I think would be good would be to take a leaf out of the Iona Communities book, and I must think about joining them, where you have to give an account to yourself, an account of yourself to your fellows in the community of how you've deployed your assets, your income and wealth in the course of the previous year. So I would like, if we managed to set up a kind of mega community, including people like Patriotic Millionaires, that would be a community where you were accounting to each other for how you've deployed your wealth and your income. But yes, I would like to see that disclosure.
Thank you. Hi there. A lot of the government's narrative at the moment is about growth, economic growth. How do you think the enough is enough narrative can be made compelling in the face of that?
Yeah. Well, this is a whole other question, but we've had enough growth as well, and we can't have much more growth. I work closely with Tim Jackson, so you may well know him, author of Prosperity Without Growth, in the Centre for Understanding Sustainable Prosperity at the University of Surrey. And we have grave doubts about whether growth as we know it can continue. At the very least, we always have to say, well, what kind of growth, where, for how long, of what, and with what impacts? There are lots of things we would want to grow, such as the renewable sector, but quite a lot of things we would want to see contract. And there are lots of things whose growth we should question, such as the AI sector. So we've got to be much more nuanced about growth. Where Rachel Reeves goes wrong, I think, is lacking that nuance, just having the view that quantitative growth in the economy must be good. The more of it, the better. Well, that's just not true. It may well be as well that we have reached some natural limits to growth. The efforts that governments have put into boosting the growth rate for the last generation have not worked. And one thing that was meant to happen, of course, was that cutting the taxes of the top 10%, and especially cutting the taxes of the top 1%, the top 0.1%, was meant to kickstart growth, because they would unleash their entrepreneurial energies and the wealth would trickle down and the economy would grow more. And that has been disproven time and time again. So growth, in its conventional sense, simply can't be the answer.
I work with a lot of young people, and I'm wondering how we engage young people who have a totally different approach, for example, to work, possession, etc., not least because they're paying university fees, which we never had to. They can't get houses because they're paying so much in rent. And many of them just seem to feel alienated. And yeah. When I try and engage my colleagues in conversation, they're not even interested to listen.
Yeah. Well, young people need to get angry and get organised. And I'm amazed that more of my students don't. And this might be controversial, but I think somebody's got to start targeting. Maybe this is something that can be thought about more. We need to understand more of what the children of the top 1% and the top 0.1% think about what their parents are doing. And can those children demand more of their parents? Can they break away from their parents' values? Can they look at the world that their parents are going to bequeath to them and say, it is not good enough that you are going to leave me enough money that I can build myself a luxury bunker? That is not the inheritance I want. I want to have a better world, not a better bunker. So I think looking at the attitudes and values of the children of the rich is going to be very important. But as for the rest of the youth, they've got to get angry and they've got to get organised. And they mustn't be alienated from politics, because that's all we've got. They have got to start running for office, and they've got to start really hammering away at their MPs, not being passively alienated.
Can I ask if you have any ideas about how we might deal with the corporate world? One of our colleagues from Christian Climate Action went to the Shell annual general meeting. She got some shares so she could get in, and she posed a question from the floor. How can you morally convince us that what you are doing is acceptable when all the science is totally against what you're doing, you know, the expansion? And it was a complete disconnect. It was, morality doesn't come into it. This is just business. I mean, this is, to me, an attitude that is just solid in the corporate world. What can we do to break that, do you think?
Well, it's a very good question. I'm not even sure it's a solid consensus in the fossil sector. Now, the fossil sector has got some sociopaths at the top. But don't forget, the fossil sector is also full of people who want a better world. They just need a job, and it's not easy just to walk out. So I'm quite happy to demonize people at the top of the fossil sector, but not everybody working in it. And I'd want to say, hopefully, that within the business world, it's possible to drive a wedge between the sociopathic part of the business world and the morally concerned part. And there are a lot of morally concerned companies and business associations. The problem that they've got is that they are not as well organized or as determined or as ruthless as the fossil lobby. So they've been herbivores up against carnivores. And as I will say to anybody who will listen in the business world, it's no good saying that you don't like to get involved in politics. Your opponents in the fossil sector are in politics. They know they're in politics, and they use politics really well. You've got to get as good and as ruthless as they are. So there is quite a big pro-sustainability, morally sound business community. But they're badly organized, they're not determined, and they need to become much more decisive and ruthless and realize that they've got to call out the fossil lobby and they've got to call out companies who are not aligned with them, not just politely keep quiet about them. Their opponents are not keeping quiet, nor should the pro-sustainability business world. And I've said that to anyone who will listen. And sooner or later, the gloves have to come off within the business sector. And the people who would agree with what I'm saying, and a lot of business people would, have to start fighting. It's not happened yet. I hope it will.
Two super quick last questions. They're coming together.
Yeah.
Yeah, good afternoon. Have you heard of a guy called Gary Stevenson, who is part of Patriotic Millionaires? He has a YouTube channel called Gary's Economics. He was the most successful Citi trader in 2011. And he is doing exactly the same that you're saying. He is fully in favor of wealth tax. He has the momentum. He has over 1 million subscribers. And anyone that subscribes to his channel basically will be supporting the wealth tax campaign that he is a part of.
Yeah, I'm very happy to endorse that. So do have a look at Gary's videos if you've not seen them. The point, though, is having all those followers has got to translate into political influence, and it's not done that yet. So that's why I'm calling for some kind of coalition, some agglomeration of all the different movements that we've got, who use phrases like enough is enough, like the Patriotic Millionaires, like Gary. The influence that they've got has got to become much more political, and it's got to have much more weight. And you get that through numbers and agglomeration.
And that's really where my question comes from, that a lot of those statistics about Patriotic Millionaires, those willing to pay more in the top 10, the vast majority, we don't hear that. Because we've had a media that, in my opinion, has spent 40 years making us all as self-centred as possible so they can get away with being as self-centred as possible. How do we tackle that?
I completely agree. So we should implement the Leveson recommendations straight away. We should put restrictions on media ownership. And as I said before, we've got to have an information pollution tax. That's another topic, of course. That's another hothouse.
Thank you very much, Ian, and that's a great place for us to say we've got to draw this to an end, but thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.